This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry in all its many forms. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I'm talking to Charisse Hawkins, who's one of the founders of a relatively new company called Beneath the Ink, which is a platform, I would say, a building tool set for the creation of ebooks that integrate various media elements into the storytelling. And it's, to me, a really interesting approach. And I wanted to talk about it with Charisse and get a sense of what is the basis of the thinking behind it and, you know, what is the creative vision and where they're going. So how are you, Charisse?
Good morning, David. I'm great.
Well, it's really good to talk to you. And hopefully we can explore a little bit more about what you're doing. But why don't we start with you talking a little bit about yourself and, you know, how you got here. You know, what's your background? What have you done before? And what's motivated you to get into the ebook business?
Absolutely. Well, my background is very interesting, I have to admit. One of my first jobs out of engineering school, I have a couple of engineering degrees and have always been interested in science and technology. But one of my first jobs out of school was as a Walt Disney Imagineer. And at the time, I was engaged in designing theme parks and rides and shows all around the world. And I think that's where I fell in love with the intersection of technology, creativity, and storytelling. And that really informed my career from that day forth. My last position, fast forward a decade or two, was Vice President of Software Development at Time Warner Cable. Again, large-scale technology systems, customer-facing, user experience, and storytelling and allowing people to have a great entertainment experience. So that was a consistent theme throughout my career. And I had a lot of success doing the corporate experiences and leadership of large teams. But I really love books. I love reading. And I was looking over, you know, kind of at what was happening in digital publishing and realized that that's a place that I really wanted to be a part of. The digitization of books and content was an exciting, dynamic change of pace. And I decided one day to literally walk out of my corporate job, that was on Friday the 13th, actually, and start Beneath the Ink to pursue what we could do to revolutionize digital content in the print form.
But this is not, you're not motivated by wanting to tell your own stories. You're really motivated by wanting to help others tell their stories.
Exactly, exactly. Bringing that technology experience, understanding how to build large-scale, easy-to-use tools is in my DNA. And I wanted to bring that ease of use to the masses and allow people to tell their story just a little bit better and be able to create a cross-platform and compelling experience that was, again, easy to use, cost-effective, and really let the content shine. I tell people that if we're doing our jobs right, then the technology falls away and people are really just more deeply engaged with the story.
You mean the reader experience?
Exactly, exactly.
So we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what's your concept of who will use the tool set you build? Is this going to be a platform where, let's say I, as a user, maybe an fairly experienced builder of books would be using the platform, or do you intend this for the average author who might be interested in trying to figure out how to tell their own story in a more, interactive or active way than simply in written form? They're interested in ways that other media can push the story forward that they have to tell. Are you aiming for the novice writer or the experienced book builder?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I think the answer is both. We appeal to those that have a lot of experience producing content and books, as well as first-time authors and those that are just getting into this the delivery of the material. I think sometimes people confuse complexity with how powerful a tool can be, and I frankly disagree with that mentality. If you can attach something to an email, an image to an email, then you can use our author portal and create very engaging, very powerful curated experiences for your readers. So I really think that's one of the areas of expertise I bring to bear to this problem, which is how to make this easy, fast, accessible, and cost-effective, but also incredibly powerful and incredibly beautiful and elegant to the reader.
Do you think, I mean, the thing that I guess, you know, I'm going to take a little side trip here down an issue that, or to an issue that I think is really interesting, and that is, let's, you know, taking what you've just said, you know, I tend to think that there are two kinds of users, and probably more, but this is kind of just to simplify it. You know, there's someone who really has a concept of how to integrate various elements into a story. You know, it's not, I mean, it's hard enough to tell a good story, and it's really hard, I think, to figure out how visual and audio and kind of exterior elements can be used in a meaningful way. And what you worry about, I think, is, you know, that people get entranced with new tools and they sometimes would maybe overdo the use of all of these other elements just because they can. So you think about, you know, people build, you know, there are lots of tools that allow you to build your own website, but they don't necessarily teach you what is good web design or, you know, and people sometimes just have no clue. So they build really ugly, unusable websites with great tools that are readily available.
Right.
And then somebody else who really kind of gets the vision of what it is like to use a website, they will build a beautiful and functional and wonderful website that has a lot of elements that make it really usable for me as a user. So, you know, the thing you worry about, hearing what you just described, kind of naturally, and of course, you could argue that the same effect is true or the same conceptual framework applies to writing in general. If, you know, there are lots of people who write really bad books and, you know, just because, you know, the typewriter is available or the computer, or the word processor, whatever it is they use, the tool is not going to make them good. The tool is going to allow them to express themselves however they do that. So, you know, obviously you don't have a responsibility as the platform builder any more than the, you know, Remington did as the typewriter manufacturer or Microsoft or Apple do as the manufacturer of computers to ensure that the quality of the material produced with their tools is any good. But you can contribute, I think, to making those tools used better by the people that engage with them. And I'm just wondering if that's something you've thought about and kind of grappled with and figured out a way to interact with users to help them not, let's say, put in, you know, 400 photos in a, you know, a 200 or a 1,000 word book or something like that.
That's an excellent question. And we're often asked to, you know, speak about our technology, and you were the first person to bring up a very important concept of aesthetics and how do you help people with the concepts that you were just describing. So first of all, we do a lot of focus group testing to find out how people actually read and use the final product as well as how to make the tool itself easier, more intuitive. And you're absolutely right. There are experiences that you can produce that are, you know, beautiful, elegant, and obtrusive, and there are experiences that can be jarring or not necessarily move the story forward. One great example is how you have to use video in a very artful form. And we've got tons of data that tell us when and how people want to experience extra media in their book. And if you imagine reading, when you're reading, you usually have You're in a quiet place. You are hearing your own voice in your own head at your own pace. When you watch video, or if you were to click on a link and see video, all of a sudden it's somebody else's voice. It's at a different pace, and you're having, you know, a lot more visual and moving experience there. So we tell people there's certain places and there's certain times where video makes a lot of sense. But there are also places that it absolutely does not work in the content. So we can give people guidelines around what we've seen and what we've heard and actual testimonials from people that have used the product. The other thing we found out was less is more. And when every time that you open a Bink, you want to be delighted, you want to be informed, you want to learn something, you want to have a great experience. And so in general, having a Bink every 3 to 5 pages is has been the suggestion that we've given content owners, and it has borne out over and over and over again across various demographics of that's about the right number of Binks that people want to see in general. It's not to say a single paragraph might have a density of ideas or concepts that would benefit from Binks, but in general, that's a very good rule of thumb. We also have tools that make suggestions for where Binks might be a great asset in the material, and that's a starting point that people can use.
You probably better define again when you talk about a Bink, because it's just an unfamiliar term. You know, it's one that you've created. So this describes does this describe any media piece that's inserted into the book that you know in your platform? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. It's any place where you can touch on a word or phrase and reveal what is beneath the ink. And interestingly, most people enjoy having plain text, images, video, and audio in that order.
Right. In other words, your research indicates that readers are most interested in text,
yes.
And that audio is the... But that's an interesting, kind of observation, because, of course, Amazon, for example, has made a big deal about including audio in their ebooks as a way to experience it both while you can read and when you might not be able to read, you can listen to the book. Maybe that's a different thing, because what you're talking about is the audio element that enhances the experience at that particular moment.
Right. Supplemental audio that can be one of my favorites. We had an author who said the characters in his book had names that were difficult to pronounce. So being able to, and for me, when I'm reading and I run across something like that, I will just say to my head, okay, the character that starts with the letter S, and I keep moving on. But he was able to actually provide a correct pronunciation in Sanskrit of the characters' names. And it was a beautiful way to provide that material to the readers, to hear his voice, to really understand and have a deeper connection with him as well as the characters.
So do you also find that the variation in the nature of the extra material, and I'm trying to resist the term enhanced, because
yes, please do.
no one who's involved in producing ebooks which have multimedia features wants to call them enhanced, but we still haven't come up with a decent term to apply to them. But have you found that, as I suspect or believe, that different types of books also can have different degrees of engagement with other media? For example, a fictional story, you might try to do less in order to continue to enable the reader to use her imagination to the fullest, where you don't give the reader too much that would fill in for their or substitute for their imagination. Whereas
correct.
In a nonfiction book, particularly one that's trying to tell, and maybe they're all telling stories, but one that's got a lot of connectives into the physical world, that might enable you to go deeper the way many textbooks do. When you're studying a subject, one of the great things about digital platforms is that the digital allows the creator to give the reader much richer and in more in-depth information about a particular subject.
Yes. I think there's two answers to that question. The first one is you can't prevent someone from, when they're really interested, they're going to naturally go out and do their own research in Google. And what you can do, though, is either take them more directly to the material that is relevant, that is maybe the most compelling, the most beautiful, the most accurate. And so being able to do that and save them the experience of searching, but also allowing the reader to truly see from the author or the content owner's eyes. I think it's the greatest benefit and the greatest praise for an author is I really do want to see what's in their mind's eye. And this is a great way for you to be able to do that. On the flip side, I don't necessarily want to see a picture or an illustration of a character. You tell me they've got dark, you know, hair and green eyes. It's nice to be able to conjure up my own image of what that person or that character might look like. So it really does depend on the content itself and how strongly the author feels about wanting to reveal more of what's from their imagination. We do find from most readers, though, that say, if I'm in love with a character, an author, or a series, I really can't, you can't saturate me. You can't give me too much information. I'm just inherently interested in as much as I can get.
And I think besides offering the Beneath the Ink platform to me as a potential user, what happens after I create my book? Do you also act as the distributor? Are you going to help the author figure out what to do with it? And then, of course, that leads to another set of questions which relate to the compatibility of what you create with different platforms. And, you know, we know that the limitations of some devices and some apps prevent media from running. And, you know, I guess, you know, we can talk about that later because I think it's a bigger issue. But, you know, what do you do with your new user, let's say, who wants to create a book? You know, do you have to kind of give them guidance along the way about what it's going to look like on each of the different devices? And then, you know, how do they get that book onto all those devices?
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, we do a lot of education around the experience on different devices. And we, from the very beginning, said if we couldn't do something that was truly cross-platform compatible, then we didn't want to even start the experience. Because we don't feel like authors, you shouldn't penalize a reader for having the original Kindle device as opposed to, you know, reading on their phone or more advanced tablet. Yet there are limitations to what those devices can truly render. You can't play audio or video on, you know, the original Kindle from 2007, yet it's still a fantastic reading device and many people have them. So we took the approach of first and foremost being cross-platform and then having the best graceful degradation we could imagine for the content. So if you put a panoramic image in your book that's available to read on a more advanced tablet, then we substitute that image with something that's, that doesn't move, you know, a single image for other devices that will be e-ink or black and white. I think that's important to be able to have the broadest reach and make sure that the material is able to meet the readers where they are. In terms of distribution, we have some affiliate relationships with two different distribution groups. We looked at doing distribution ourselves, but we really realized that our core competency is making the tool, making the adding of binks and curated material as easy as possible. We wanted to iterate and innovate in that space, and there are plenty of opportunities to work with people. Or authors are becoming more savvy themselves, and those that self-publish know how to put, you know, distribute and have accounts with the major distribution houses already.
Okay. And so, well, let's talk a little bit about the platform differentiation and, as you put it the elegant degradation. But let's go with, can we assume that the software is optimized for the iBook and iOS output platforms? And that
yes, we support those.
Right. So, but what happens, you know, because there are, as I believe, at least as we are talking in today in 2015, there are some things that I could do in an ebook that the, let's say on Kindle devices, it would be supported in a Kindle Fire. But not necessarily in a in every Kindle app. So you have a fair amount of managing to do there. When I, you know, if I create something that will work on a Kindle Fire, in many, at least from what I've seen, in most cases, most of the software optimizes for the device that that will run the multimedia, but does not offer a version for some of the simpler devices or apps that won't support video or audio. So, but what you're saying is that you actually do. Like, if I created a book on your system, it will run on an iPad. It will run on an iPhone, obviously. It would then also run on a Kindle Fire, and it might run on a Kindle app. But it will also, what you're saying is, it will run on all of the other lesser platforms with modifications that you're making on the fly.
Yes, yes. And that was, as I'm hearing you describe that, I think about the journey that we took to make that possible. And it was a challenge to actually have that be create in one central location, but then have the output be a Mobi file, a Mobi that does not have audio and video, a EPUB2 file, EPUB3 file. So we have four formats that we support, the ones I just mentioned, as well as our own custom format called Webbook, where you can read any of this content in a browser. And that was truly the challenge of being able to make the creation one central place that's easy and fast for people to do the creative work, but have the export process be something that could be automated and could also reach this wide breadth of technology. There's very few cases where one is expected to have the same experience or a similar experience on something as old as, you know, as 7 or 8 years ago when technology moves so fast. But again, we felt very strongly that you should be able to meet the readers where they are, and people might have a Kindle device as well as like reading the Kindle app on another device. Why penalize them for those choices that might be made for very different reasons? What you take on vacation versus what you carry around with you every day.
Right. No, and I think that's been a serious issue, I think, for ebooks in the kind of the challenge of readers accepting ebooks that have multimedia features, because there have been so many challenges for creators in terms of making those books available on a broad scale. I mean, there are a lot of iPads out there, of course, but I think they're used principally for other media than books. And the irony is the Kindle, which is probably the most important and widespread reading platform of all, has not supported audio and video except in the very high-end devices, which I don't know. I have no clue how many there are out there. But the presumption is the heaviest readers are using the simplest devices. They want the experience of reading to look as much like reading that they're used to as possible. So they like the Kindle Paperwhite, for example, or the Nook, the simple Nook. So it's kind of interesting that you've done this, because I think that's something that I can't think of anybody else who's done that.
No, nobody has as crazy as we were to embark on this journey.
Right.
So.
So your business model is, I guess there's one other thing, and that is, I do know that you will produce books for people as essentially a studio for hire, in addition
Correct.
To making the platform available, because there are obviously some users who either don't have the time or the expertise or the willingness to take on becoming builders of multimedia ebooks. So that's another part of your business, even though I think structurally I have to assume that's not what you consider to be your primary business, nor would it ever be, because you simply get paid for your time there. You don't get to, you know, leverage your technology as much.
It's been interesting because those people that have asked us to do the work for them on our services tend to be more established and have larger platforms. And those that come into the portal for a single project, maybe smaller first-time authors. So we really do reach the full spectrum, and we enjoy both. I mean, I believe that our purpose here is to allow people to make their content the best it can be, reach the largest number of readers that they possibly can. And as long as we're fulfilling that vision, then we're happy to work with, you know, people at all different levels.
So your business model is based on having more users, you know, having a large number of users over a period of time. Roughly, what does it cost if you are a builder, you know, a user of your platform, and I want to build an ebook? You know, ballpark, what's it going to cost me?
So we have two different models. One is a licensing agreement, and actually, we've had more interest in that model to date. And so for depending on what the number of books, the number of seats, what type of material is being moved through the system, we do an individual quote for organizations, corporations, nonprofits that want to license or even white label our tool for in-house use. In terms of individual projects, we have a $12 a month access fee to the portal. And then there's an export fee associated with the different distribution channels. So for example, a Beneath Ink web book is a $600 export fee, and the fee can go all the way up to, Kindle is usually around $1,500 for an export. It can go a little bit higher depending on what type of media people want to put into the content, if they need help with audio or video manipulation, let's say. And we've had books that have been as high as $3,000, but they typically are in the $1,200 range.
So that's, in other words, if basically it's going to cost me about $1,200, maybe $1,500 to build the book. Starting from, now, you, as from input, you start with what would be the input data format? In other words, let's say I've written a book. I've got it in a Word document. Will that work, or do I have to typeset it and have it in a PDF form in order for you to suck it into your system?
Ideally, exporting to EPUB from something like Word is tends to be the strongest, you know, the best input, provides the best output in terms of formatting. And ultimately, we're going to be moving to, you know, we're looking to move to an EPUB document at the end. So EPUB in and EPUB out is usually the cleanest and easiest in terms of formatting. We have worked on files from InDesign, and we have taken pure text files from folks, and then they can do their formatting within the tool. The hardest content for us to handle, of course, is six layout PDF. We're moving from a six layout to a reflowable text, but we've done projects where we've quoted you know, getting people help to move from a PDF, a pure PDF, into a reflowable text format.
Okay, so now moving from the kind of, you know, nuts and bolts, what would you say, what do you think is the future? You know, what do you anticipate happening over the next few years in terms of ebooks and their development and how they're going to evolve? You know, where are we in the state of ebook publishing and development?
I think there'll be a conversion in terms of additional media. I tend to not use the word media because it doesn't, people don't think of text as media. You know, we think of just images and video and audio. But I do think that there's a lot of power in how we can interconnect the material that is placed beneath the ink, having a library to draw from that could also refer to material that has similar content. From if we see a bank associated with a particular word or phrase or character or historian, and being able to know where else that is used. I think there's some interesting ways that we can see monetization as well as discoverability through adjacent material banks and how the digital publishing will evolve.
And do you think, what do you think is going to happen with the reading platforms? You know, recently there's been some discussion about how, e-reading has leveled off, and, I have my own ideas about that, but I'm just curious whether you think that this is a kind of development stage, or have things reached some sort of stasis? Is there more evolution to be had when you talk about convergence? You know, what does it mean when, 75-80% of the people in America are consuming most of their media on their phones or on tablets? You know, what does that mean for reading and the kind of consumption of written materials in different formats?
I'm fascinated by what's happening in general, but also generationally, of how people are consuming content. And we think about how much more we read on a daily basis and the different places devices that we read on. It's amazing that we now have access to so much information so readily, always literally in our back pocket with our phone, for example. I'm very bullish around what's going to be happening in terms of evolution. As a technologist, that's been my observation throughout my career. And I just laugh when people say, yeah, things are flattening off or change. You know, we're kind of done with all the change. And for every industry I've worked with every product that I've ever worked on, that evolution and keeping your mind about where this could go, what new types of things we could produce. For example, we do what we call a freestyle sprint once a quarter. And there's never a shortage of, oh, we're done with that. There's no more fresh ideas of how we can add additional material or what we're curious about. So as long as there's curiosity and there's creativity in the world, I think that it bodes well for things that a year from now, we're sitting here talking about ideas and geolocation and connectivity that we hadn't even imagined.
Yeah,
Go ahead. I'll give you one example of something that happened to me and my family. We happened to be reading. We were in London on vacation, and I happened to be reading A Brief History of the World. And I happened to be at the chapter where they mentioned that the Rosetta Stone was in the Museum of London. And we were within walking distance of that museum. And I told my daughter, so we went. You know, who wouldn't want to go see the Rosetta Stone? It's surprisingly small compared to what I expected. But I thought about what if my book could let me know how close we were to that experience. I would have been completely frustrated to have read that particular chapter and section on the plane coming back to the States. There's all kinds of things like that I think are definitely within the realm of possibility, and we are exploring them in our company. I'm sure that there are others that are doing similar ways to connect the real world and connect content and to satiate and satisfy people's curiosities as they're reading.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that the evolution of tools is that people's use of tools never keeps up with the evolution of the tools. So there's always a lag, you know, when something great is invented that a lot of people figure out how to use in new and interesting ways that will make people who experience the output happy, then you'll see a change in the way that people think about that technology and the experience that they're having. And that kind of, it becomes geometrical, you know, that the more interesting books that are produced, the more readers are looking for them, the more other creators are inspired to use the tools, because we are always looking at what other people are doing and reading other people's books and using that as both inspiration and challenge to ourselves creators. And I'm sure that's true for technologists as much as it is for writers and artists and, you know, creators of all kinds. So I think that what you're describing is potentially a really interesting period ahead of us.
I agree. think that, again, you do have to respect the story and the fact that people over and over and over again tell us, we like this because it's elegant and unobtrusive. I think those words we hear over and over and over again. But it's not unlike the transition that happened in film. I mean, to go from black and white to color to now, you know, computer-generated, we take things for granted, the special effects and the things that we see in movies today. But it really was, you know, moving, taking it up from black and white to technical, adding Dolby sound. I mean, it's a pretty good analogy for what is possible. It doesn't mean that the story, that we've taken away from the story, the movie experience is still something that's such a huge part of our culture and what we all enjoy doing. But it has evolved over time, much more engaging, and we can do it more.
Oh, I agree. I agree. Well, thank you, Charisse. Very interesting to talk to you about Beneath the Ink and what you're doing, and to hear your thoughts about where we're going with ebooks and technology. So I really appreciate talking to you.
Thanks for having me, David.
Well, my pleasure. So this has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I've been talking to Charisse Hawkins, who's one of the founders of Beneath the Ink. And I thank you so much for being on my show.